Welcome to the Pinecast. Joining me, as per usual, is Joseph. You can follow him on Twitter at I Hate Your Club. And welcome to the Pinecast. We have Robert, Mr. Robert Burns. You can follow him at RobertWFD on Twitter. Good to have you, Robert.
What's up, guys? That was pretty nerve-wracking.
It certainly was.
Pretty much.
The last 15 minutes or so.
It got a little nervy.
The injury time was a little rough.
Yeah, certainly a little bit of squeaky bum time. We knew we weren't going to get out of there with any less than 4 minutes of extra, you know, additional time. I kind of had it on call when that happened. But,
yeah.
You know, all in all, a good result. How are you feeling now? You said you've been a bit nervous, but.
Well, I mean, in context of the historical result, yeah. Like, I have mixed feelings. Of course, the result is fantastic. When you look at, you know, 100-year history pretty much of what we've been able to not do down there. So kind of in the spirit of 97, when you see a result like that, and I guess the bummer of it, there's two bummers to the whole thing. I mean, again, I'm ecstatic about the result. I would have taken it a million times over before the game started, but when you see the situation, you know, a lot of this just had to do with our injury list and with Landon Donovan being gone. We couldn't, you know, we had to really do a defensive focus, and you can't, you know, there's no way to give enough credit to what the back line did. I know everybody's talking about Omar, who was fantastic. Beasler, for his first real big game, to be able to walk into Azteca and to be able to pull off, after maybe about first 10 minutes nervous, to pull off that, you know, that kind of performance was pretty incredible. That's the reason he's the reigning, you know, defender of the year here. So you got to give him credit for that. But for me, the warrior, man, he was heroic, was Beasley. I know he got caught a couple times out there, but, you know, for him to be coming back into this fold, to be playing in a position he's not, you know, obviously used to, but there was a lot of times when Aquino was trying to use his speed and Beasley got back. He was beat up. He had the hamstring. They stepped on him. I mean, he was, I can't say anything more than heroic about Beasley tonight. So, and after having watched him since wow, late 90s and you know, when he was coming up with Landon, to see him come back into that role, that was huge for me too. So, everything was about the defense. They had to makeshift it, and those guys came through huge. That's that spirit that somehow or another, I think all those problems that were going into camp with the, you know, with the Brian Strauss article and all that, that was the, you could see the culmination of a team kind of coming together and just getting the job done. And they really did it on the defensive side.
Yeah, I really saw a lot from Beasley today, especially in the second half. You know, I'm sure everyone had their worries, and particularly when we got that early yellow card. You knew they were going to target him. It really seemed like he was in for a dreadful day. And he did get kind of he had a tough run for a bit of a while in the first half. But he came through that, played very solid, especially through the second half. I mean, I was worried, especially, you know, once we kept seeing the multiple knocks he kept taking, you know, I was kind of thinking like, well, you know, can we bring someone in for him? But the reality is there weren't really many options. You know, there's no one really for us to even put there in instead, you know, because he was there only as really only there because of the lack of options and the lack of fitness of everyone else.
Well, they had Morrow, but that's, again, that kind of a game to put him in a situation like that. You could have also had the you could also have the possibility of maybe putting Breck Shea back there, but he's coming off an injury, obviously not used to playing that role as well. So, yeah, I mean, like I said, for me, that's warrior-like from him to be able to, you know, take all those knocks and to still stay playing the full 90 and being an integral part to them getting that huge point.
Yeah, I think, I mean, going into – even when the squad was announced, I was worried about this match and that defense, trying to figure out who was going to play there. Cameron was really worrying on the right because of his lack of pace and ability to get back. Also, his recovery pace isn't that great.
Yeah, I mean, for me, going into this thing, one of the, you know, the most telltale problem was, you know, at right back, not having Chandler, not having Chirundolo, that we didn't have the option of being able to move Cameron into like a D-mid spot where he's comfortable. He's more comfortable in the center of the park, obviously. And to not have those guys, I mean, look, this was a makeshift team. I mean, we rarely have the amount of injuries to the back, obviously missing Fabian Johnson, Danny Williams, the entire German contingent. But then on top of that, we also, you know, without having the threat of Landon, and I think tonight was clearly obvious, because when you see guys, I know Zusi and Herc did a lot of defensive work tonight. But those aren't guys, or maybe in other games at home, I guess it was probably just, you know, the tactics at Azteca. But Zusi, I see him regressing in a sense. Like I said, I think that one play where he came back and headed the ball away late, unbelievable defensive play. I will give him 100% credit for his defense today. But we still need guys who are able to have that no fear to take somebody on and to just, you know, run on that touchline and just absolutely get after people. And that's something that you miss not having Donovan there, because at the very least, wherever he's playing, he's always pushing it forward. And so that's a big loss. But, you know, like I said, you have to take into account all of the injuries and all the absences. And, you know, from the defensive perspective, fantastic game. Sad that we had the best opportunity ever probably to pull off a win based on the conditions, playing a night game, having already trained at altitude, all those factors. Had we had a full team, let's face it, this was not our best team. You know, but you got to give every single one of those players another, you know, this is some props to MLS, I guess, because every single one of those players tonight that was on the pitch at some point in their career played in MLS. So that's a huge, huge sign about where our league is going, to be able to at least produce guys. But by no means was this our best team, but they gave a great performance.
Yeah, they certainly showed the spirit, and they kind of came together and showed what we needed in terms of, mental toughness and, you know, aggression and really full commitment to the cause over the match.
I think we always, we kind of have that. It always kind of runs through our teams,
right?
Especially our talent isn't always the best.
And exactly to that point, you guys are familiar with what Bruce Arena was saying before, when all this stuff was coming out about the Brian Strauss article about, you know, the German players having maybe a different mentality.
Right.
They're American, for sure. But I think that that's what he had in mind, is that American mentality that other, you know, that foreign coaches or coaches in other countries where they have American players, they talk about that attitude that American players, when they just dig deep, they do whatever it takes to get the job done. They don't complain. I think being American, it's like they realize how lucky they are to be playing this game, which was never something that was for us. And I think that that's what Arena kind of had in mind when he said these guys are being developed in Germany, a whole different kind of way of thinking. Nobody's questioning that they're American and that they love wearing the shirt. But at the same time, it's how you grow up and that kind of mentality that's bred, you know, growing up in the States. And I think you saw that most definitely on display tonight, because they had no business getting that point. And yet somehow or another, you know, like I said, Guzan, huge. Omar, huge. And I don't think it goes. I don't think that we've had as calming an influence in midfield. I don't think that I've ever felt as comfortable with a player finally getting his touches on the ball. Every time the ball goes to Michael Bradley, I feel safe. And I haven't felt that since Claudio Reyna. And that is, I think he was unbelievable tonight as well. So, you know, it's just that spirit you're talking about right there that it kind of permeated through this squad tonight.
Yeah, in particular in the defense, though, I mean, with everything that we saw, you know, Guzan only making, you know, a not so frequent start of his, you know, actually getting playing time today with a makeshift defense, you know, so it's not even just the fact that he's coming into the normal back four for the United States.
Right.
But, you know, coming into a makeshift defense and all of them having the stability and calmness back there and composure that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have expected. I mean, they handled everything pretty well, and our organization was, I don't know, definitely better than I would have expected. So, you know, a lot to say for him. I thought he was very commanding in goal and
right.
Had a pretty good performance. There wasn't really too much I thought he could have done better. I think he could have punched one out better, but I think at the end of the match, on that one corner, he came out and handled that one corner perfectly.
Yeah, well, who would have thought that the problems at Aston Villa, because what Guzan had tonight was basically what he's facing week in and week out at Villa, which
right.
is a completely unsettled back line, a young, inexperienced back line. He's dealing with taking 20, 30 shots a game probably, having to make at least, 9 to 12 saves a game playing at Villa Park. And that translated. I don't think he could have stepped into a situation that was even more familiar than that tonight. And so that is that, you know, chalk all those things up to some dumb luck, because in a sense, he was more prepared for that kind of a situation than Tim Howard probably could have ever been. That's not to say that Tim Howard doesn't step back into the number one spot right away. Brad Guzan will have his time, and I think that that time will be after the 2014 World Cup, but that cup still belongs to Tim Howard.
Yeah, you'd have to say he'd come straight back in. I mean, he's done nothing to lose his place, and, you know, you expect it to, you know, resume back to normal.
Right.
But it's good to see him performing like that, and, you know, like we said, competition can only be a good thing. You know, if his form is that good,
yeah.
Hopefully it keeps, you know, Howard on his toes so that he's ready to step back in and knows he has to perform, because especially with Guzan keeping himself fresh in everyone's mind, you know, we're seeing good things, so
right.
he can't rest on his laurels.
Well, even if you go back into our history, you know, let's say our modern history, the one place where we had never really had too many worries was at goalkeeper, be it the transition from Mayola to Keller, Hahnemann, Johnny Walker, Friedel. We always had that. And then all of a sudden you started kind of wondering now with Tim Howard, like, oh, great. Who's, you know, there
who's
wasn't
next?
Really somebody there. And I think that Brad Guzan, you know, when he was at Chivas USA, you'd hear, oh, this is a great kid, this and that. And then he went.
Yeah, but I wasn't too convinced that he would be the next man for the USA back then. Yeah.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And so that's a great feeling to finally know, you know, when you go down the line at some of the great teams in history that they've all, this all boils down to a question of depth. And what tonight did, like I said, this is by no means our best team, but this is the kind of thing that adds to that depth and experience that you're going to need at every level, because you're never going to have every single player available. You're never going to always have your best team available. You hope to have it at the big tournaments, but you can't always guarantee it. This is exactly the kind of experience that these guys need. Now, every single one of these guys that might have to step into that role, let's say Donovan comes back. Okay, Zusi, at least we know. You know, he's got this experience under his belt. When all these guys are getting just this valuable experience, that's going to add to the depth of our team. And one thing you'll see of every big tournament team that wins big ones is that they always have depth.
Yeah, and that's something that we've been sorely lacking. And so anything more that we can see of some of these players developing and getting that experience is only going to benefit us in the long run.
Yeah.
Joseph, so we saw a couple guys start up front. I thought it was a bold move from Klinsmann to start, you know, Gomez and Altidore. You know, together, you know, playing two true strikers kind of seemed like a bold move going forward, but either one was very effective. What did you think of our offense?
Obviously they didn't get much service. You know, I mean, Mexico did a great job once we did get the ball into midfield for the most part. There were a couple of good runs we made, but for the most part, they pressured and got that ball basically passed back to our defense. But when we'd lump a ball forward and try to get one of the strikers to hold up the ball, they were not successful doing that, either one of them.
Right.
I don't remember Josie touching the ball that much at all tonight.
Yeah, he
wasn't getting into great spots. But like I said, when you're just lumping it up like that, I mean, that was so anti-Klinsmann ball tonight. But again, I think you have to look at the circumstances. It was frustrating in that sense to have that lack of offensive cohesion whatsoever, to have any chances. And when we did get the guys, like I said, you know, the wing guys, when we started off in that 4-2-3-1, and you just never saw Zusi attacking or Herc attacking. And like I said, I don't know if that was a directive to try and just, you know,
right. It's tough to know what tactics they were.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't sit there and say maybe the idea was to try and keep as much possession as possible. But it's certainly not going to get us a win. And that's the kind of the frustrating part, because, you know, we only get this game once every 4 years. And, you know, I look forward to this game immensely. This is for me, I don't want to say it's as big as a World Cup, but when you only get this one game every 4 years, it always means something incredible. So,
yeah, it's our toughest qualifier by far. And it's nothing.
Yes. And you know what? The honest truth is, you know, even if we wouldn't have gotten this result, it's a fantastic result. But again, in context of the hex, in context of qualifying, we have already, our two toughest road games in the hex are out of the way. It's already, and we have seven more games now in order to qualify. So I think it's the big picture. Nobody remembers, you know, U.S. had a dismal 2006 World Cup. Nobody remembers that we won the hex in 2005. Played okay in 2010. You know, nobody thinks about the fact we won the hex in 2009. It doesn't really matter all that much as long as we get into the big dance, because that's really what only people are going to remember years down the line.
Right, and then we're seeing that right now also with Mexico. You know, look at the way they cruised through the last round of qualifying to get into here, and everyone thought they were going to breeze right through. And I've got no worries. Mexico's going to get through. They'll handle business, but it's obviously there's that air of doubt that's being cast about now because, you know, they haven't had much of a return. What, they have 2 points from their opening
game? 3 points.
I'm sorry, 3 points.
They haven't scored, right?
So, you know, they're not scoring any goals. All of a sudden, things are going to be coming into question. People are already talking about they want Chepo out, all this kind of stuff like that, which is obviously a little bit early. You know, he's done a relatively good job with them so far outside of these couple results. But, you know, I have friends that seem to think they might have too much of a dependence on Chicharito, you know, because if Chicharito scores, they do well. But other than that, they're not really getting too many goals from elsewhere.
Right. Well, remember, they did score two in Honduras. Remember,
they did.
Their son came back. So it's not like that. What I think it is, if you think about they. They're missing – you remember what a great – as much as we hated him, how great a playmaker was Temoc Blanco, okay?
Yeah.
When you don't have somebody pulling those strings – a Messi is terrific because of guys like Xavi and Iniesta. You have to have somebody who's pulling those strings. They don't necessarily have that right now. You got Gio Dos Santos who's kind of running around. You know, he's on the wing, he's inside, you know, he's kind of running everywhere. He doesn't really, you're not getting that service that he probably needs that he does get at Old Trafford. And so I think that's, you know, that's a big part of his game. And Guardado, for as talented as he is, he's definitely dropped off a little bit. And he's not playing as well as we all know he can. So I think that and let's face it, there was a lot of pressure on Mexico tonight, and at every second that went by on the clock, that pressure built on them, and the crowd built on them.
You could feel it mounting, a kind of slow wave. You know, it was increasing as it went, and you could hear a little bit of groans. Surprisingly, the crowd didn't really turn on them too much. You know,
not until the final whistle did they really express their displeasure as one.
Right.
Which, you know, a lot of times that can set in at halftime or the 60th minute with that crowd.
Yeah, you can certainly hear those groans earlier on quite often. But, I mean, the only way to look at this, though, I mean, they've dropped 2 points at home. That puts us, like you said, I mean, what a favorable position it puts the U.S. to have gotten these fixtures out of the way. Yeah. But, you know, the U.S., you know, Mexico having dropped those points is almost even more vital in a sense.
Yeah, they're dropping them at home. And right. You know, we dropped 2 points, but we got points away.
Yeah. So, you know, with that said, there's going to be talk about, and people are already mentioning it already, about the potential of wanting to bring back Carlos Vela into the fold for Mexico, you know, with the lack of scoring options and his good form in Spain. I understand the argument against his inclusion, you know, the fact that he turned down his last call-up. But undoubtedly, you know, these are one of those situations where the Federation doesn't want to swallow their pride and make that phone call. But sometimes, you know, the actions that precede it kind of force their hand. You know, they wanted to be able to do well in qualifying. The way things were going, there's no need to make that kind of move. But is De La Torre going to have to do something like that to try to right the ship, so to speak? You know, you got a player in good form.
Yeah, but I don't think it boils down to one man. I think he's experimenting as well. You always have to see it this way, too. Mexico hasn't lost yet either.
True.
So, you know, in the long run, I don't think anybody has any fear that Mexico's not going to qualify. Let's face it. It's 3 out of 6 spots. They're going to qualify. They're going to get better. It's an unbelievable amount of pressure right now. And I don't necessarily think that it boils down to one guy. I think that they'll be just fine. And I'm just glad that, you know, like I said, you know, that we got this game at Azteca out of the way. I don't think that they're going to have too much trouble down the road. And much like the overreaction that happened here before these two games in the U.S. and that everybody was sitting there saying, oh, you know, fire Klinsmann and do all this stuff. I'm sure that's just magnified right now. And as a U.S. fan, it's wonderful to know that that's, you know, they're going to crucify Chepo tomorrow in the newspapers in Mexico. I mean, they're going to go nuts on him. But at the same time, you have to have some perspective on this thing and say, hey, Mexico hasn't lost yet either. Obviously, 2-0-0s at Azteca is not great. But if you see the big picture, I think that they're going to be just fine. And I don't think that necessarily, you know, when you start kowtowing to players who are refusing to play, and maybe it's a little bit hypocritical because that's, in a sense, kind of what Donovan's doing. I mean, he's taken his little sabbatical, but he's basically, you know, he should be here right now.
Yeah, certainly should.
But it's a different situation because obviously it was understood that he's taken that time off, whereas Vela was invited to come and said, no, thanks. So it's obviously a much different situation. But you run the risk also of you know, if they do try and get him back and make it seem like such a huge deal to get him back, it, you know, what message does that send to the other players?
Right.
That the player is more important than the badge, than the shirt. And that's not a great message to send. So I'd be very, very surprised if they did that.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a bit of a, you know, long odds for that to happen.
Yeah.
But we'll see what they do moving forward. I'm not too worried about them. Like you said, they will qualify. It's not something they're really that worried about at the moment.
Right.
And I expect them both to do work. We're going to see, well, with the results today, we saw Panama win, which shockingly kind of sends them to the top of the group. If we look at the standings going into the next round, we've got Panama and Costa Rica. Well, Panama ahead of Costa Rica, USA, and Honduras, all level on 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
With Mexico sitting right behind. I mean, you have to think that Panama probably won't maintain this pace. You know, you would think, but it leaves kind of a wide open race, really, because everyone's within, you know, one match from there's 3 points to separate first and sixth place.
There's one match from going to top of the group.
Yeah,
basically.
That's all that you have there. So there really hasn't been much of a separation yet. It's been too early to say too much.
Right.
But I mean, how do you see this group shaping up? I mean, really, I'm just curious, who do you think really is going to make that run or take that third spot? If we're going to say that USA and Mexico are going to straighten things out, who of these pretenders are really going to be someone that we can expect to make it, you know, make the run?
Well, I don't think you can deny it. Like I put Honduras very high up there. I think, you know, I haven't seen the game tonight in Panama. I'm going to watch that after this. And but I still hold them in a very high regard. I think that they are a quality team, and I could probably see Costa Rica finishing in fourth. I think for all the complaining and all their, you know, wanting to replay the game against the U.S., I think now that they got that win tonight against Jamaica, they'll be. I think that they'll be feeling pretty good about themselves as well. So again, I think it's early. I love the parity that you're seeing in the hex. We haven't really had it like this good, and every game is going to be tough here. I mean, look how much trouble we had with Jamaica in the semifinal round.
Yeah.
And obviously Panama is not going to be a joke. You know, we're familiar with some of the players here now. You know, Gomez, who played, you know, Philly last year, and obviously Blas Perez in Dallas and stuff. So, you know, I think it makes it really interesting that we're seeing so many more. We have to realize one thing, that while MLS also, you know, is a great benefit to the U.S., it's also a benefit to these other countries as well. Because now, they believe me, there was a big wall to get into Mexico to be able to play for the clubs in Mexico for these guys. So, you know, they had to be the absolute, you know, top of their game. These guys are getting other chances now because now that there's this other league available where they are close to home, where they have an opportunity to obviously have great, you know, training facilities and a very serious competition that we have here. We're raising that tide for every other nation in CONCACAF. You know, now they have another viable option to play someplace else as well. So, you know, I think that this is the effect of that, where we're going to see a huge amount of parity coming up in CONCACAF. So really, even for us, as much as we want to think that this is going to be a walkthrough, kind of like it was, you know, back in 2009, it's not going to be the case. Every single one of these games is going to be tough. And while we might be riding high and feeling really good after beating Costa Rica and drawing at Mexico, I don't see us running the table from here on out. I could very easily see us losing a game. Obviously, the game at Saprissa, where we've never done well.
Right.
That's another possible stumbling point. Playing at the office in Kingston is not going to be easy, especially depending on where they are in the standings. So, you know, everybody has a shot at this. But for me, obviously, U.S. and Mexico should top the groups. Their quality should come through. I see Honduras finishing third, and then Costa Rica probably playing that playoff against New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the last round against Jamaica, they've just been flying up the wings against us constantly.
Yeah.
Right.
That was constantly an issue.
Right.
But, you know, the good thing is, like you said, we are seeing a bit more parity. And as opposed to years past, there's really there's going to be competition from top to bottom. And there's no such thing as an easy qualifier in coming from CONCACAF anymore.
Nope.
So moving on to South America, we saw a few matches today, Argentina getting a draw. But I think more interesting, when we get down into the spots, the fourth and fifth place, it kind of gets kind of it's a bit crowded, you know, because the top couple teams have been doing really well. Ecuador sitting on 20 points now, Argentina ahead of the pack at 24. But once we get behind those two in Colombia with Chile, Venezuela, and Uruguay, I mean, I think we're seeing some certainly some warning signs for Uruguay. You know, a few poor results on the bounce, which are on the back of a few other bad ones. You know, another loss today, a 2-0 loss to Chile, has dropped them from fourth to sixth place. And they really look like a team that's really lacking
something.
Well, it looks like the team's getting a bit old. You know, they went on that run. This is basically nearly the same team as we saw in the 2010 World Cup. You know, guys like Forlan have not been playing to the, you know, not nearly the same level that he was back then.
No.
Guys like Paulito Pereira has looked like garbage. You know, he got sold from Porto to Inter, but he really hasn't looked that. He hasn't impressed at Inter. He hasn't played well while playing for the national team. And then guys like Lugano are getting old and really doesn't look like he really should be there anymore.
Yeah, it's a bad little run. Plus, you know, the main guys up front, when you think about that, you know, that little tri-tip attack they have up there with Forlan, Cavani, and Suarez. You know, Suarez is really the only guy who's really, you know, in great form. And you know, Cavani's not exactly playing exceptionally well right now, although you can't doubt his class. But, yeah, I think that it's a cyclical thing, but this is a bad run. I don't think that seeing Venezuela – as much as I'd love to see the Vino Tintos in there, I don't think that they'll be able to keep it up. Chile is just as indifferent as Uruguay in that sense as well, because, you know, you expect to have the guys that play for Chile and the talent on that team, you expect them to be a little more consistent. Yet, you know, they lost to Peru recently, which was great for me being a Peruvian.
Right.
so, you know, even Peru still has a shot, which is fantastic. So I think it's, you know, again, you know, the parity down there is, you know, it used to just be everybody else besides, you know, Venezuela and Bolivia. You could just pretty much mark out. They'd always have these rough and tumble battles. But for me, I really my favorite team to watch in there is Colombia. I really, really enjoy watching Colombia now. And that whole, you know, when you remember the generation, you know, the Valderrama.
Right, that came to 94.
Exactly, Lionel Alvarez you know, that generation, and then how bad of a drop-off they have. For them to be coming back the way they are, and I think they're not going to call it a shoe-in to get in, but I think that they'll be back as well, and that'll be great to watch. But Uruguay, Tabata's is – I think that they'll sort it out. It's a really, really awful run for them right now, which is very, very interesting. I would like to see more of the games before I can sit there and say, you know, exactly what the problem is. But, you know, I think, like you were saying, Lugano, you know, you're talking about that Musleta, you know, changing over from the steady competition in Serie A, not saying that the competition in Turkey is worse, but, you know, changes of scenery, right. Players moving around a lot. You know, Lugano's situation obviously wasn't very settled after going to PSG and then,
right,
you know,
getting
leaving
minutes.
There and stuff like that. So sounds like there's a lot of unsettled players there as well. So, but I still think that they should have enough to turn it around and get in there. I just don't see Venezuela keeping up the pace, but I wouldn't mind seeing Venezuela in there either. So,
yeah. And I think, I mean, even though Colombia didn't really get a result today, they've looked good in qualifying. Falcao's been performing for club and country, you know, and the spirit that team embodies, they've definitely been exciting to watch. And it's been refreshing to see them kind of get back to that level that it's been so long since we've
Absolutely.
Seen them playing with that kind of flair and, I don't know, passion.
I agree.
And that's been good. So let's get to that one. We had one big match today in Europe. You know, there was a lot of qualifying. We saw England draw 1-1 with Montenegro. But there was one big matchup in France, and that was Spain against France in Paris. We all got to watch that match. Spain getting the victory. Joseph, what were your thoughts on that? What did you think was really the deciding factor for Spain?
Well, Benzema was not good again.
Yeah, and this
that
is what
kind of stuck out.
This
to
was
me.
His 12th match running, right, without scoring, I believe, yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, it was
over 1,000 minutes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was surprised. He's on a Torres.
I was going to say it's a Torres like streak.
I was surprised that he wasn't pulled off a little sooner. I mean, not. I think Giroud came in at what, the 90th minute,
93rd
minute,
93rd, something like that.
I was hoping he'd come in a little sooner. I actually hoped that he'd come in. I think when they brought Sissoko on, I thought he'd come on. But yeah, I think Ribery had a couple of chances, one on ones up front. But I don't know. I'm trying to really remember what stood out for me. I just Benzema just stood out for me with his poor play,
his lack of skill. Yeah.
It's time to recall Thierry Henry. but obviously the red card was huge when Pogba went out. That obviously changed what they could do on their substitution. So you didn't really have the liberty of bringing in a Giroud necessarily in that situation when they had to defend first. So yeah,
they seemed a bit hamstrung, you know, due to that. But I thought,
but they're already down, so maybe go for it.
Yeah, you were down, so you kind of had to go for it. And I thought Pogba had a pretty impressive match in the most part.
He was good.
I was really just watching him right before his two cards, and I was trying to really watch him and his movement because physically he's such gifted with his strength and his size.
I think for me, one of the bigger disappointments. I don't know if you guys are familiar with. All the trouble that Yanem Vila's had throughout his career.
We're very familiar with it. Arsenal fans being linked with him for the past four seasons.
And one thing that you see the better French sides, they always had that kind of number six, that kind of holding guy who was, you know, the best teams that they had in the '80s when they had Tigana in that position. With Platini, and then you're talking about when they had Deschamps and Vieira running that. I think that they're not. I'm not saying missing that, but somebody who can do the kind of job that like a Xabi Alonso does. And I thought that Yanem Vila would be that guy because he has all the tools for it.
Right.
And I think that's one big piece that's missing to France right now is to have that guy that just kind of stabilizes the middle for them, but can also, you know, a real box to box, but who can defend like a bandit, but who can also spark that attack forward. They're not getting it out of Matuidi. Pogba's, young, raw, whatever you want to call it. There's definitely that kind of hole there. Kabaye is obviously going forward a lot more, so you're not going to see him doing that kind of defensive work and cutting things off. I think that's a huge part of France. Hopefully Yanem Vila, because he seemed like the heir apparent in that role for France, needs to get himself back on track and utilize that talent, because I think that would be a huge, huge asset for them. But I love the play of Valbuena. I think Valbuena is a super young, well, not that young. I think he's about 28 or 29 now. So, but Valbuena is, I think, a pretty immense catalyst for that offense. And you know, I could very easily. He's a very small guy, but I was on Twitter today after watching that game, and it doesn't look like Marseille's going anywhere, and I could easily see him. You know, now's the time. That he could be making a move to Spain. I would love to see that because I just think he's like one of my favorite French players right now. So I would love to see him make a move out of Marseille where you get to see him on a more regular basis.
Yeah, he was a real driving force, I mean, for them mm-hmm. today.
Yeah, he did a lot for them. And especially Spain seems like it would suit him, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, it seems to cater his style of play and, you know, who knows how he would really cope with the physicality of the Premier League. I think he could do okay, but it seems like Spain is more suited to his talents.
Sure, sure.
It doesn't pain me to see him starting over Nasri. I tend to enjoy that myself.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, can we do – what do you guys think about the Adu non-call? Just kind of going back to that since there was a
– Oh, yeah, we should have gone over that. It seemed like – actually, you know what? Here's the funny thing. In real time, I thought it was a great tackle because it looked like it was executed correctly. I thought he got his leg around, but then on
right.
I thought replay, it was a penalty.
It looks like it was a penalty. So.
Yeah, it was pretty stone cold coming from behind. I mean, there was one angle where it looked like he got on the ball first.
Yeah, it did. Like he got through his legs almost, but it looked like a penalty.
It's what's truly amazing, though, is if you think about the entire history of U.S. qualifiers in Central America and Mexico, obviously, is those are calls we never, ever got. Right. We got the most ridiculous calls again. I don't know if you guys remember Costa Rica back. I think it was in 2001 when Reyna had that stupid handball called. We lost that game 2-1. All sorts of things that have happened in CONCACAF with the referees over the last 20 years. And to actually imagine – now, the one where Chicharito went down on Bradley, I thought he was just a
– That wasn't a penalty.
Yeah, that was not a penalty for a million years.
No,
but,
not
Adu, we got away with one there like you can't believe.
Well, I was surprised. I'm always surprised when we go down there and finish with 11.
Right, exactly.
I really am. I didn't think we'd finish with 11 today.
Yeah, especially the calls. After our left back and one of our center backs get carded in the first 20 minutes.
Exactly.
You don't. The odds certainly don't stand in your favor by that point.
Yeah, but that's a big call, and I'm sure that's the call that they'll refer to constantly. And we probably would too. So.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you guys about, what your opinions on the substitutions, because obviously Jurgen Klinsmann is under a microscope. As far as what he's doing tactically, his tactics will always be questioned, and his motivational skills will not, but his tactics will, because everybody thinks that everything that they accomplished in 2006 was up to Yogi Löw. So when you think about his substitutions, you know, for me, I was always kept thinking that they were going to bring in Beckerman to try and hold it back. And I think he was going when he was putting in Shea and Davis to try and kind of stretch out the defense a little bit, give him something to think about, which obviously didn't work out great. Tonight was all about the defense digging deep. I don't want to say criticism, but whatever our plans were to disrupt them trying to go forward late, which were the substitutions that he made, those did not work.
No, and we our defense suffered a little bit then. I mean, anytime everybody will know listening that Beckerman is my least favorite player.
Right.
I didn't necessarily have a problem with the substitutions, but yeah, they didn't seem to work, especially in that last about 6 minutes or so.
Yeah, it seemed like conceptually I didn't mind what he was doing in the sense of like you said, was trying to establish with and trying to kind of come at them. And I thought it was it kind of an intent, you know, he gave the impression that he was going for it in a sense by making these moves as opposed to bringing on Beckerman and just shutting up shop, which,
right.
You know, being 80 plus minutes into a match at the Azteca, you know, if you have a nil-nil, you hold on to that result. And if we hadn't held on to that result, that might be rightly criticized, you know, in retrospect. But, you know, hindsight is 20/20 at all. But it's, you know, we're in a results-based business.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, had he made that, had they pulled it off, it would have been a whole other story.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you could see that he doesn't have a lot of faith in Beckerman as well.
For Joseph's mental
health. Yeah, which I can understand. I mean, you know, Beckerman can have one or two decent games in the shirt, but usually they're ineffective. He obviously doesn't play the same type of game that he does in Utah, where he's very good for RSL, but really translates
at that level.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, at RSL, he plays his role and performs well.
Yeah, he's certainly an MLS all-star, but you know, how that translates is a whole other story.
It doesn't. That's the whole thing. It really doesn't. And, you know, my concern before that, you know, considering how well Adu did in the friendly win last year at center back, where he's, you know, it's much – he can use his athleticism. It's not as much time on the ball. I mean, some of the giveaways he was giving away were absolutely making me throw the remote control at the TV. I was going nuts when he was doing that. But to put him back in a center back role the way he played with Cameron when they won last year at Azteca, and I was thinking, okay, lesser of two evils. You know, we didn't really have any options. We couldn't move Cameron over there, so you put in Beckerman and you basically just made him – you know, stay at home, play defense, but that was going to limit our offensive capability. So, you know, at the end of the day, you can reread into every decision that was made. But at the end of the day, we got the result. We got the point, which was huge. And, you know, well done to, like I said, forget about the offense because that's just going to frustrate me. But under the circumstances with the injuries and stuff like that, the defense was heroic tonight for sure.
Yeah, they put in a shift without a doubt.
Oh, yeah.
So in regards to another keeper that we saw today that also put in a good performance, who wasn't the normal custodian between the sticks, was Victor Valdez. I thought he had a really good match for Spain. Mm-hmm. Very solid in everything he had to do. Very sure-handed. He really – it just goes to show how much, you know, the depth that Spain has, the amount of players they rotated in and the absolute lack and drop-off in quality is, yeah. you know, is things that any country has to be – you know, drooling with envy yeah. over, pretty, you know, because I mean, how many changes they make to the side and they all fit in seamlessly.
It's pretty sick when you can bring in Juan Mata in the 92nd minute to kill time. You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
And then you think about, you know, when it goes even beyond Valdez and Iker, you know, you got Reyna and then, oh, by the way, who's our keeper? De Gea. He just happens to start for Manchester United. So, yeah, an embarrassment of riches for sure. But again, that's what we were talking about earlier. That's why you're talking about the, you know, two-time reigning European World Cup champions. I mean, when you have that kind of ability to mix and match, you saw Jordi Alba was out. Okay, who do we put in? Oh, just, you know, just the Arsenal starting left back.
He put in a good shift. He should have had three assists, and he ended up getting the one for the goal. Right. So.
Yeah, he was key on that. So, yeah, when you have that type of ability to just kind of bring in players who are of that caliber, you know, you're not going to lose a lot of matches. I think the main thing coming up with Spain is just going to be – I think it's just the mental focus is to be able to keep that edge that you need to win at that level for – you know, coming up now, it's going to be what, you know, 8 years since, you know what I mean? By 8 years since, from.
Well, we're what, 6, 7 years almost? 7 years since the one in 2008, right?
Yeah. So counting up until, let's say, five.
Sorry, five years since they won in 2008.
Yeah, it's been a damn long time. Let's put it that way. It seems like it's been longer. But yeah, I guess if you look at it that way. So from 2008, you know, to be able to keep up that mental focus to go into a sixth year of winning it all next year is pretty remarkable. And I think that that is Del Bosque's biggest, you know, he doesn't have any problems worrying with the talent and the ability to play. Because, again, you got the majority of that team that's all – you know, playing together at Barcelona or at Real. And, you know, you got the occasional stragglers that are coming in from Man City with Silva or Mata, obviously coming in Chelsea and stuff. So you have that mixing and matching. But Del Bosque's biggest job is just how do you keep those guys motivated for so long to stay that good? But, you know, they're still getting the job done. So, you know, they're still going to be the odds on favorite to win it next year.
You know, and they have, until they fail, they have to be because, I mean, they've only shown, it's not like the squad is lacking any quality, you know, as compared to before. But like you said, motivation is the hardest thing for them to be able to maintain. I mean, you know, you look at championship teams, regardless of sport, to be able to go back to back or back to back to back. You know, when we talk about, you know, we're from LA, we look at, you know, the Lakers teams that have done that in times past. It's hard for anyone to be able to maintain that focus because, you know, undoubtedly some of these things can go to players' heads. You know, they can rest on their laurels. There's so many factors to you know, bring into play.
Right. And remember, they've also evolved a lot because when you remember back in that 2008 team, one of the main components of that European Championship winning team was Marco Senna, who was playing in a very, very strongly defensive midfield role, which they is pretty much abolished. It doesn't even exist anymore. So when you look at it that way, not only has the team stayed motivated, but they've also evolved and become something better as time has gone by. If that will still last into next year's World Cup, that's going to be the big question. I have, you know, I have my doubts just because I think it's so difficult to do, and you're seeing, you know, little bits of kind of chinks in the armor coming in, but very, very little. So still odds on favorite, but, you know, it's also going to be being played in South America, whole different atmosphere.
And it takes a bit of luck to win these tournaments. You know, things absolutely have to go your way. And they're about due for one call to not go their way or the ball to bounce the wrong way. Because, I mean,
you know,
obviously they've made their own luck with the talent and the effort they've put in. But, you know, you have to get the rub of the green a bit.
Remember, in 2010, every game they won on the way to the final was a 1-0 victory.
Yeah,
it's not exactly like they were blowing people out and stuff like that. Like you said, you got to get the luck. You also have the luck of a healthy squad, which is huge. But again, that's a testament to their depth because it seems like even if one guy would go out, you know, they've survived the David Villa being out for a long time, just, you know, without any problems at all. So. You know, it was actually interesting to see them playing today with an actual striker, which was kind of fascinating, you know, to get away from there. You know, their basic, what, 4-6-0 that they were doing.
Yeah, you were talking about their evolution, and I was going to talk about how they have evolved into playing without a recognized striker.
Exactly, exactly.
When you're surprised to actually see a striker on the pitch for them.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And to the comment you made earlier, I mean, talking about the class that they have coming in off the bench, the three substitutions that Spain had today were Jesus Navas, Cesc Fabregas, and Juan Mata, you know.
Yeah, no problem.
Guys who walk into the first 11 in most any, you know, most any other country in the world.
Oh, ridiculous. Yeah, I'd love to, I'd love to have Navas playing.
Like
When I juxtapose with Zusi's inability to go forward, when I think of Navas, who will never stop going forward on that right sideline, and Zusi turning around every time. Like I said, I'm giving Zusi credit for his defensive work tonight, but his inability or fear of taking somebody on compared to somebody like Navas, who just, you know, doesn't have an off button when it comes to going forward down that right wing. You know, that's just something that, you know, I'm patient. I've been watching the U.S. for, what, 20, 25 years now. So I can be a little bit patient a little bit longer. We'll get there. But, yeah, it's definitely interesting to see that embarrassment of riches with Spain.
Going back to the U.S. match, I thought that Dempsey was rather poor also today.
Yeah, I've never –
he gave up on a lot of runs that he didn't want to make.
Yeah. He seemed tired. I don't know how much it took it out of him, but he's also coming off that injury. So maybe it was the training, you know, maybe he had to kind of step it back a little bit because of the injury. There's a couple factors there. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be questioning that in the coming days, and we'll probably get some answers soon. I'm sure he's going to address it because, yeah, by far, he's usually the one guy that you can always rely on to be the most dangerous for us, and it just wasn't there tonight, so... But again, I think tonight, I think everything that had to do with our offense tonight, you can just throw out the window because that's not us, or at least I hope it's not us because we're not going to get much success and we're certainly not going to bring in a whole bunch of fans. That's the other opportunity that was missed tonight in one sense. You know, this is the kind of game that had huge, massive mainstream interest around this country. And all we did, this is the worst part for me, is that we fed all those trolls that sit there and say, oh, soccer, 0-0. That's the sucky part, because all those people are going to be like, oh, wait, I got all hyped up about this game and it was 0-0. You know, what the hell's that?
Yeah. What kind of game ends with no goals?
Right. Yeah. And then we're celebrating it like a victory because they just don't understand the concept of it. But, you know, that's you know what? I gave up trying a long time ago, trying to convert every single person in this country. The game itself sells itself. So
I don't honestly care anymore.
Yeah,
whether
exactly.
you like the game or not. Trust me, it's a good game. You don't want to watch.
Now that we get every match on TV.
With
the exposure we have now, it's absurd. The absurdity of riches is what we get in terms of television coverage. I mean, I think around like 1 o'clock today here on, you know, here on the West Coast, we had, I don't know, 6 or 7 matches live. Well, not even including the ESPN3 matches. I mean, just like what was on TV between ESPN2, ESPN Deportes, Goal TV. Univision Deportes, BN in Espanol, BN in English, you know. You know, it's come around in that sense. We can't say we haven't been developing in that way.
Yeah.
You can't live in a better country for football than the U.S. as far as being a fan and an observer.
And imagine saying that 10 years ago.
I mean, I remember, you know, the Fox Sports World when Lionel Bienvenue was on there, you know, talking about, you know, and that was like a huge thing. Like, oh my God, we get to watch some Premier League games now. And then, you know, and then I hear back about the old Toby Charles days with the, when they used to cover the Bundesliga years and years and years ago. And, you know, to see where we are now is incredible because I've lived in numerous countries in Europe and you have to pay a fortune only to get your own league. You could see, it'd be like Champions League games. Like when I was living in Germany, you'd see Champions League games, but only the ones that the German teams were in. You'd see UEFA Cup games, but only the ones the German teams were in. You certainly wouldn't watch Bundesliga games. The only thing that you would see would be like a compilation every single Sunday where they would show basically highlights of all the games, which was great, but you never got to watch games unless you paid some ridiculous subscription fee. You know, again, every country in Europe is so dedicated kind of to its own league, they don't really bother with the other ones. So we have such an amazing amount of coverage here that to say spoiled is a massive understatement as far as the kind of coverage we get.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I know. As we sit and revel in it, hop between our UEFA mix during Champions League days, it's good. I never could have – I don't even know – I wouldn't even have dreamed of it being this good a few years ago.
Even a few years ago, I mean, it was good.
Right.
Yeah.
It just keeps getting better.
Well, that's what's showing the growth. I mean, you know, again, you don't have to convince everybody on the street to follow the game. There's the silent masses, I guess, that are, you know, it's gathering and you see it week in and week out. You know, you can see it at MLS games, which is great. You know, that's hopefully the next big step is, you know, you want to see, you know, every single MLS game sold out. You want to see top players coming in here. You know, it's all about the evolution. And if you've been following the game for a long time, you know, I've been fortunate enough to be into, you know, coming up on, you know, 20, 25 years of watching this game develop. And to be able to see that, you know, over the course of that time is a truly remarkable thing. I only wish I was 20 years old now because I'd really love to see the next 60 years of it. So, yeah, hopefully I still got another 60 or 70 left in me. And well, that's probably wishful thinking, but at least 40 or 50 so that
I can,
you know, sitting on a rocking chair and just, I can only imagine where it'll go, you know, in the next 20 years, you know, when you look at the last 20 years and how much the game's grown,
the amount of growth that we've seen,
another 20 is going to be
desert football league.
Yeah.
It'll be good. We can only look forward to it. Well, we can thank a lot of that due to the Premier League and what it's done for us. We have that action coming back to us now. So quickly before we go, Robert, how many more matches before your United clinch the title? Because we're really one of the biggest worries for us as Arsenal fans is that they're going to come and potentially do it at the Emirates.
It's definitely on at the Emirates. I mean, but better, it's got to happen there. I mean, I almost hope that if they better work out the math so that it happens there. It's going to be great. But you know, it's great. You know, it's obviously a huge response from what happened last year. I think Fergie was so focused on it this year because of how dreadfully close it was. I mean, to lose a title on goal differential.
Yeah.
It's so arbitrary. You know, you could go to another country where, you know, just a different set of rules about, you know, maybe, you know, in MLS, it's, you know, tiebreakers are now based on number of wins, or it'll be, you know, head to head points or something like that. Every other country, you know, every place is different. So to lose a title on goal differential, not even have to have a chance to, you know, do a playoff or whatever it might have been. And I think obviously that, you know, the 6-1 thrashing last season. I don't think that there was any doubt for me that United was going to take this title this year. But, of course, I think like that every year. But it's still
– we used to think like that.
Yeah, you did. And Arsenal, you know, I want to see Arsenal successful again. I mean, the league needs it. I think it's great for them. I think it's just a question of the problem at Arsenal now is it's a club that's losing – its best players. It's a club that's getting known for losing its best players. And when you've got a culture now that's set in that says, you know, hey, Van Persie's gone, Fabregas left, Nasri left, right? All their best players are leaving. Right. Everybody's thinking you're going to get guys in there like Gervinho, you know, which aren't necessarily going to bring you back to the glory of the old days. And now, after, you know, coming up on 8 years now without a title, you're talking about a place that the top players in the world, are they going to be really, really incentivized to go to North London? Are they really going to want to go there now? You know, is that going to be their first choice? For the lesser players, like I said, for guys like Gervinho coming from a league like Ligue 1, and that's going to be a stepping stone, absolutely. Even in a certain sense for Podolski, because he had the opportunity at Bayern, didn't really do great with that one. Plays unbelievably for the national team, went back to Köln. That was not for him. I think it was like his next opportunity. I love Podolski, but again, it's a stepping stone for him to try and get back into that big time. So, you know, I think Arsenal, the club prides itself on being like a very well-run business, and that's absolutely the case. You know, there's hardly any big clubs that run their books as well as Arsenal does, but at the same time, that's going to wear thin, and hopefully it is wearing thin.
The last 2 years, it's worn thin this year. I mean, this was the explosion of the thinness. I don't know how to explain that properly, but the goodwill is gone.
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. You know what? And I know this is going to sound horrible to you guys, but I'll tell you this. Not finishing in the top four would probably be the best thing to happen to Arsenal.
No.
Yeah, we have different. We know. We see the 1 point. We do. We see the 1 point, and then the other point
is it would be the top.
Well, look at what.
Right.
here's the big thing is that look at what happened to Chelsea. Chelsea were on the brink of a disastrous season. Very fortunate to. Let's be honest. They were not the best team in Europe last season, yet they did win, you know, the Champions League. And that changed everything for them. Hazard wouldn't have signed with them had they not won the Champions League. You know, you think of, like, the recruits you're bringing in, you know. Like, if Arsenal really do hope to challenge for something next year, and that by that I mean FA Cup, anything, you know, you need to have the players that we need to bring in to sign to be able to make that happen are players that are going to want Champions League football. Not those who are willing to suffice for Europa League. So
I still don't think we're ever going to think like that.
But I'll tell you what's different at Stamford Bridge is that they have an owner who's willing to spend whatever it takes. So every player that goes there knows that they're going to have an owner who's still going to be, you know what, if he doesn't win it this year, he's going to spend more money to do it. And that's not the case at Emirates. They know, regardless of – you can sit there and complain about Abramovich's quick trigger finger. You could sit there and say all these things about him, but the man spends money to bring in the players that he needs. And if you look at Chelsea's trophy haul since he came in, regardless of what it is he does, he has still gathered results. He's still gotten trophies. He's still doing whatever it takes to do it. Yeah. A lot of people have problems with Roman Abramovich, but when you look at his trophy haul, you can't. You can't fault him for what he's done.
They can't complain. And that's why those fans aren't protesting him. You know, they might protest the coach, but they wouldn't dare, you know, bite the hand that's the only hand that's brought them any success, you know, in their short history. You know, and to your point, though, we talk about that. And when you look at American sports franchises and those that are the most revered, the most feared, the most hated, but also the most respected, you look at teams like the Yankees and the Lakers, who, like you said, have owners that are willing to pay year in, year out to have the best talent and the best chance to win a title.
And
when you have a foundation like that, I mean, obviously – you know, that's where Arsenal fans lose their patience is because, you know, you have such a great infrastructure in place that if you threw some money at it, it could make, you know, people say, you know, people think it could make all the difference, one or two players, that extra bit of money. And who knows, it very well could be. I think that's the frustrating part.
I think they got a little bit spoiled, obviously, in the early 2000s because, you know, the choices that he made, they were all risks. You think about when Wenger brought in Thierry Henry from Monaco, for example, he was a winger.
He made
that change to move him there. And then, you know, getting all the other guys that he does, Perez wasn't some huge star. Freddie Ljungberg wasn't, you know, they were known quantities. But these are the same types of guys that they brought in, and they just happened to find a perfect storm getting, you know, obviously with Gilberto and Vieira and all the guys that they brought in there, along with the more established guys that had been there. You know, they had like a perfect storm of bringing in that talent. That hasn't been as easy anymore for Wenger to find those guys because he's tried to find that magic again, bringing in these guys. But let's face it, the money has exploded ever since the summer of Ronaldo and Kaká. Even before that to a certain extent. But when you're talking about 50 million pound transfers for Fernando Torres and, you know, 92 million for Ronaldo and all these exact, you know, just completely ridiculous numbers.
25 for Adebayor.
they couldn't compete like that anymore.
No. Well, the thing is in those years also, you know, regardless of whatever the prices are, there are more teams competing in those price brackets,
absolutely.
You know? Like in the early 2000s, well, one, Chelsea wasn't spending that money yet. City wasn't spending any money yet.
Absolutely.
You know, so in the sense that even if without the prices being so inflated, there just weren't that many other competitors at the top of the league.
Sure.
And that dynamic has changed.
Right. I mean, it was only Arsenal and United. I mean, let's face it. That was pretty much it. Then all of a sudden, now you've got really, if you think about it, you know, Liverpool, Man City, Tottenham, Arsenal, Chelsea, Man United. I mean, the Premier League has, you know, it's certainly not like Spain in any sense. And even in Italy, you always kind of had that mix. It was either Juve, Inter, Milan, Roma, whoever it might be. There was always that kind of, you know, at least four or five teams competing. And you didn't have that in the Premier League 10 years ago. And so, yeah, that's definitely evolved in that case. But my fear about Arsenal is, like I said, it's just that reputation of now being more of a selling club of the top talent than what they're bringing in as far as, you know, they're trying to bargain shop, and if they keep doing that and they don't get that perfect kind of mix of players like they did, you know, 10, 15 years ago at the right time, you know, maybe Wenger's, I don't want to say he's lost his touch, because, you know, it's silly to think that the guy was a genius 10 years ago and now with 10 more years, now he's an idiot. That doesn't really work. But times also change around you. And if you've seen that explosion of the money that's come in and they've been unwilling to keep up with that, that's where the problem lies. So, but it's a mental thing as well now too, because, you know, I mean, sadly enough, had they even won that League Cup, over Birmingham,
well, you'd have the monkey off your back, you know,
people to a certain extent. Yeah, but that's still not good enough.
Wouldn't be touting 8 years. It still wouldn't be good enough, but you get the people shut up about that one point in particular.
Exactly. And I'm sure you guys are most annoyed by that, because that's the one thing that everybody's going to sit there and talk about. And, you know, and it certainly doesn't help to see Spurs up above in the table. You know, again, something has to change.
The change will be above them. That'll be the change.
You think Kroenke's going to get that involved?
No, I just mean the table.
Oh, right. Nah, I don't know about that one. We'll see about that.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, so quickly before we go, Robert, who do you think is going to finish third and fourth in the Premier League? if we'll assume it'll probably stay with United and City in the top two. How does it round out?
Boy, that's a good question. I mean, you guys are going to hate this, but I think Spurs are solid.
Ahead of Chelsea?
No, probably not. I would probably say it's going to be Chelsea third, Spurs fourth, you guys fifth.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's about where we stand. And yeah. it's not.
And Liverpool relegated.
Oh,
if we could only be so lucky.
I'd trade fourth place for that, but man, that'd be tough.
Yeah.
No, but even then, I mean, you know, there's still other guys to look out for. So, but yeah, I just, you know, I think, you know, with the season Bale's having, he's really ridiculous, but just top to bottom, I think Spurs have really kind of, found their groove. And I think that they're, you know, they're not losing to like the smaller clubs that they used to in the past that always kind of screwed them up.
I think ABB deserves credit, you know, because he's really done a job, you know, and Airy wouldn't have done this with the team this year.
Huge amounts of credit to ABB, because, you know, at that point you have to wonder, was it really ABB at Chelsea that was the problem, or was it a bunch of players who weren't willing to change what they thought they knew best? That's what you got to ask yourself then, because if he's been able to do it with a more malleable team that he had at Spurs than the old guard at Chelsea, you know, then it kind of begs the question, was it really him or was it the players?
Well, and like we said, that team was going through the phase of changing generations, and it's obviously many of them would be fighting, and having a bunch of senior players like that would resist change, you know, quite.
Right. And let's face it. I mean, you know, obviously the Chelsea midfield, for example, looks a hell of a lot different than it used to. You know, during those, you know, the Mourinho years, and obviously, you know, to see Oscar, Mata, Hazard, you know, it's a whole different team.
Yeah.
So, they've been able to, Rafa hasn't been able to get the best out of it. But let's face it, he hasn't exactly had a great platform to start with. And
no.
Had they stuck with Di Matteo, you know, who knows where they might be. You know, they might have stagnated just as much. I mean, I know he's a cult hero and, you know, obviously what happened last year. But, you know, who's to say if that was the one good run and then that would have been it. So, you know, there's always some when it comes to the managers, there's always so many huge questions, because so much of that has to do with the personnel that the owners are willing to give them and to spend for them.
Yeah. And I mean, I expect Chelsea to hold on. And I think most Arsenal fans are hoping and counting on is the fact that there is that bit of doubt that's been creeping into Spurs fans and hopefully within their squad. And, you know, on the back of a few losses in a row, they have to go this week and they have to go to Swansea, which was a very tricky tie for Arsenal, which they did, you know, they pulled it out, which is a huge result for us a week and a half ago.
Right.
But, you know, they have three losses on the bounce, going away to Swansea, another loss. You know, there is that – Spurs have that kind of – that sense of impending doom, and they always know when they're about to shit the bed, so to speak. And so they've – you know, they're already talking about that as we speak, you know, because it's happened. It's an all-too-familiar thing for them.
Absolutely.
So anything that can help increase that doubt or start putting cracks in the foundation. I'm just hoping for Michu to really put it to them this weekend and really compound their misery and really get them scared, because if the cracks start to show, that's where, they can revert back into old habits because like you said, Arsenal are used to having to dig out for fourth place, unfortunately, as of late, and that's something that Spurs fans and those who've been in the squad for a while are used to getting into that position and falling short. Even though last year they didn't fall out of fourth, they fell out of third, which ended up knocking them out of the Champions League. So, it's an all too familiar feeling for them, which, on our side of the fence, we can only be hoping for history to repeat itself.
Most important thing is United's winning the title. That's all we really need to talk about.
Yeah.
I just know that I knew that at the beginning of the season.
Revelation. Once we gave you him, we knew it was over.
Yeah. What's funny? The main thing that I'm always kind of fascinated by is nobody seems to talk about his fragility anymore with Van Persie. It seems to
it's gone. Unfortunately,
it's gone.
Much to the dismay of Arsenal fans.
Trust me, all of last year we were waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah, the man of glass. I mean, it's funny that he has somehow found some kind of resiliency that never had, or maybe it's just bad luck or something. But
some of it's luck, but he doesn't put himself in as many stupid positions as he used to. Also,
right.
Part of it is his intelligence on the pitch, because as far as Rooney says, off the pitch he's a dumbass. But on the pitch,
I care what he does off the pitch.
But on the pitch, he doesn't get himself in as many horrible positions as he used to.
He liked to come back and get involved in some reckless 50-50s quite often.
So it speaks to experience.
Yeah.
It speaks to experience. Also, there was a lot of people talked about the fact, he was at Arsenal, that he switched the physios he was dealing with, right? He got personal physios instead of using the Arsenal ones.
I think the last time he got injured, yeah.
Well, it is kind of interesting if you look at, remember, Cesc also had a number of problems that came back, a reoccurring Jack Wilshere. Has a lot of people kind of question the Arsenal physios because it seems like this is kind of it seems like always their best players are in and out of that medical ward all the time. I mean, the Wilshere thing keeps coming back and forth. He's the new RVP. He's like every single time he jumps into a challenge, you sit there and cringe going, oh, is he going to be out for 6 months after this one? Every single time I see Wilshere go into a tackle, I worry that I'm not going to see him again for 6 months.
Yeah, I the only situation, Cesc was a little bit different because we basically just ran him into the ground for 5 years.
Oh,
we had to. And, and that's one of those things, especially with the kind of injury that it was, a recurring hamstring injury. And, when you push that and he comes back and you pull him off the bench off Villa, he scores the free kick and scores the goals and does his hamstring again, you're just like, what kind of long-term damage you're doing. He still misses matches probably more than he'd like to for Barcelona because they have to rest those things and be careful because –
Right, but he also gets to play at a different tempo at Barcelona.
He certainly does.
And he's not at Barcelona, not the focal point, which means that, he doesn't have the same amount of responsibility.
Right,
it doesn't have the same type of – the same type of crunchers that they have in the Premier League. He doesn't have to face that on a regular basis, but he's also – he's one cog in a beautiful wheel as opposed to being the main man at Arsenal where everybody was focused on getting him off the ball as much as possible. So,
that team's still built for him too. If you watch the way we play, certainly.
Absolutely.
But what can you do? Well, thank you, Robert. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, guys.
Good to get a good result. Follow Robert on Twitter at RobertWFD. That's the one. And you can follow Joseph at I Hate Your Club. It's been a good week of internationals. It'd be great to have club football back this weekend, and we'll have more next week. All right. Thank you both, gentlemen. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, guys. It was good fun.
All right. I'm going to leave you tonight with a little song from Kratty featuring Erica D called Forbidden. Enjoy.
Trees, hands soft as flowers. heart can breathe. But so